again. We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Rita Sand.
As long as we walk into the voting booth and vote for the predators that are raking us over the coals, we're going to keep getting more of the same. It gives them a mandate to do more of the same.
Coming up, we'll hear from Jill Stein, the 2012 presidential candidate for the Green Party of the United States, who spoke in Chicago on a recent visit.
This isn't about me. This isn't about one person. This is about our rights as people on this planet, that we should be able to criticize our government, that we should be able to speak, that we should be able to protect our students. We should be able to have a voice.
And we'll hear from Loretta Capehart, an embattled Chicago activist and scholar whose free speech fight affects activism in Illinois and nationally. But first, here are some headlines from the Indy Media Network in Chicago and around the world with Mitchell Stepanchik.
Sydney Indy Media featured the recent efforts of Australian environmental activists who accelerated efforts against the use of coal in New South Wales. Quoting from the feature, "A banner drop at a construction site for a new coal loader terminal at the port of Newcastle in the New South Wales Hunter Valley ended when police instructed a crane that activists had climbed be lowered to the ground. Two activists were arrested, responding that they were not given warning of this forced takedown action and alleged it imperiled their lives. The protest marked the fourth consecutive stop work action against New South Wales coal projects in the week of September 3, 2012. Activists targeted expansions of the three major elements of the coal chain, mines, railway, and port infrastructure, to highlight the massive expansion of coal mining and infrastructure taking place in New South Wales and its impacts on public health and the environment. Newcastle is the largest coal export port in the world, and a proposed port terminal expansion will add 66 million tons per year export capacity if allowed to go ahead." Indy Bay reports that California police were caught in a lie attempting to create a legal case against an art student active in the Occupy movement. On August 10, 2012, Thomas Mazdat appeared before the Yolo County District Court for a pretrial hearing over 20 charges, including multiple counts of felony and misdemeanor vandalism, allegedly for multiple incidents of graffiti to campus walls, windows, bus shelters, and restrooms in Davis, California. Mazdat's legal team provided evidence that police lied about the security footage that supposedly connected Mazdat to the vandalism. Mazdat, a junior at the University of California, Davis, studied fine art and created oil paintings, prints, and t-shirts in support of political activism and the Occupy movement on campus. Thomas also took part in the internationally known pepper spray incident at UC Davis on November 18, 2011, in which police deployed military-grade pepper spray at point-blank range against seated students at a public protest. Mazdat's wrists were damaged by police at that protest, resulting in nerve damage. The police's lie on the affidavit against Mazdat led to a warrant which police then used to raid Mazdat's dorm room, which was used as grounds for Mazdat's arrest and a subsequent three-day-long jail term, during which Mazdat missed his final exams on campus and was subsequently expelled from the university. DC Indy Media reported on a disruption of talks of an in-progress corporate globalization treaty. On September 12, 2012, anti-corporate and Occupy activists disrupted the Trans-Pacific Partnership talks taking place at Lansdowne Resort in Leesburg, Virginia, north of D.C. Activists blocked delegates from entering the meeting, while a group of three activists covertly entered the talks themselves, deployed a banner inside the talks, and responded to negotiators with a mic check. The treaty in question, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is an investor rights mandate based on the model of the North American Free Trade Agreement, but focusing on countries around the Pacific Rim, including the United States, Australia, Chile, Peru, Brunei, Singapore, Malaysia, and Vietnam. If the treaty is approved, it would accelerate job offshoring among Pacific Rim countries, decrease medical access, and gut environmental standards. The text of the treaty has not been made public, even to members of Congress. Urbana-Champaign Indy Media featured efforts to protect public housing and their residents in Champaign County. Quoting from the feature, "A protest was held before the board meeting of the Housing Authority of Champaign County on Thursday, August 23, 2012, by those questioning plans to demolish Bristol Place, a largely African-American neighborhood on the North End in Champaign. This comes on the heels of the demolition of two public housing units, Dunbar Court and Joanne Dorsey Homes, also largely comprised of black residents. Local authorities have ambitions of eliminating all signs of poverty while failing to address the basic needs of those less fortunate. The protest outside of the housing authority in downtown Champaign was led by Terry Townsend, an African-American activist and former housing authority commissioner. After the demonstration was announced, the issue was pulled off the board's agenda. Regardless, a large crowd of people filled up the seats in the audience of the board meeting. Documents provided to Indy Media by Townsend revealed the intentions of Champaign administrators to tear down the neighborhood for redevelopment. The hope is to attract students from Chicago, their parents, wealthy alumni, and young professionals of the creative class to Champaign. On the North End, redevelopment means the removal of black and poor people from sight. Chicago Indy Media has been covering the historic Chicago Teachers Union strike and its larger context and aftermath. The strike, characterized as bold, inspiring, historic, widely publicized, and risky, took place over the issues of teacher compensation, job security, evaluation procedures, and sufficient classroom resources, including air conditioning in the summer. The strike could be argued as inevitable, given the increasingly neoliberal cookie-cutter Chicago Public Schools Board and the progressive leadership at the Chicago Teachers Union, which grew out of the caucus of rank-and-file educators group of teacher activists. After staging a 9-day-long strike, the Chicago Teachers Union House of Delegates voted 98% to 2% to end the strike, winning a proposed deal including a teacher salary increase, the right for teachers to craft their own lesson plans, and the preservation of forms of merit pay. Even so, the corporatization of public education continues apace. American schools remain largely segregated on racial and economic lines, and a Chicago television ad featuring Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel touting the end of the strike was paid for by a group called Education Reform Now, an anti-teachers union group.
Those are just some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indy Media website at chicago.indymedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Workers who are twisted, tricked, and robbed. The peasant in Guatemala in a sweatshop got your job. She can't feed her family on the pennies that she makes. Meanwhile, the crime rate's rising up and down the Great Lakes states. Like vegetables left in the field, the signatures smell rotten on the contracts and the deeds that push the race down to the bottom. They load the rubber bullets, they fire another round. I'm heading to the tear gas. Dig in, man, hold your ground. For Joe Hill and Cesar Chavez, who fought in their own time. For our brothers and our sisters up and down that picket line. For the unnamed and unnumbered who struggle brave and long. For the union men and women standing up and standing strong.
Dr. Jill Stein is a Chicago-born physician and political activist who was named the 2012 presidential candidate for the Green Party of the United States. Dr. Stein has become the first Green Party candidate in U.S. history to earn enough small-level donations in enough states to qualify for federal matching funds. Dr. Stein visited Chicago on the evening of Wednesday, September 12th. This is a recording of a portion of an impromptu speech at the Grafton Pub in Chicago, where Dr. Stein spoke. We joined Dr. Stein discussing the Chicago Teachers Union strike, which was underway when she gave her speech.
These are the people who are coming into education and essentially dismantling the work of a century in building a public education system. So I just want to say that the Chicago teachers are absolutely the heroes and the heroines of the day. We have cringed as one union after another attack on our public schools and has basically endorsed the politicians who've been leading the attack. So it is just so exciting now that the Chicago teachers are leading the charge to stand up not only for public education, but for an economy that works for everyday people and actually creates a future for those children. Ending the free trade agreements for for this war on drugs, which needs to be ended, when we need to legalize marijuana because it's a drug.
Yeah.
It's a substance that's dangerous because it's illegal. It's not illegal because it's dangerous. So we've got the solutions. The public supports these solutions by substantial majorities in poll after poll, calling for example, a universal single-payer health care plan under Medicare for All. Of some profiteering CEO provides comprehensive health care. The whole thing of you, not your favorite organ system or leaving out your least favorite organ system. It's all of us because we're only as healthy as the weakest link. And you find that out when you get sick. You need to be covered entirely, including chronic care and pharmaceuticals and mental health and reproductive care, the whole nine yards. And the good news is we can cover it all and still save trillions of dollars over the next decade. That's the well-kept secret. We can actually cover health care for all and save trillions of dollars. It's far cheaper than providing. So this is just one of the many win-win solutions the public is clamoring for. The Chicago Teachers Union is leading the way in education and in a decent economy and in representative democracy and holding our elected officials accountable for once. And thank goodness that you have actually started to stand up to do that. Because as long as we walk into the voting booth and vote for the predators that are raking us over the coals, we're going to keep getting more of the same. It gives them a mandate to do more of the same. So we're saying it's time to stand up to that fear campaign and those smear campaigns that tell us we have to be very afraid of ourselves because, you know, they point to Nader Bush Gore and they say, oh, look at all these terrible things. But what they're forgetting is that Nader did not steal the election. And the exit polls in Florida actually showed Nader drew equally from Democrats and Republicans, but the vast majority of his votes came from Ross Perot voters by about an 8-to-1 margin. His votes were coming from independents who otherwise would not have voted. This is basically a scare tactic to silence you and to eliminate political opposition. So it's time to reject this politics of fear. Because where has it led over the past decade that so many progressives and people of conscience have been frightened into silence? What we've learned is that silence is not an effective political strategy. And the politics of fear has actually brought us everything we were afraid of. The expanding wars, the massive Wall Street bailouts, much bigger under Bush, under Obama than they were under Bush. The expanding free trade agreements that offshore our jobs and undermine our wages. The attack on our civil liberties, you know, in which Barack Obama has codified all the violations of George Bush, and in fact gone far beyond in criminalizing protest, in creating the right of indefinite detention for the president, and his right even to assassinate whoever he wants, including American citizens. So we have gotten in droves all the things we were supposed to be quiet in order to avoid. We've gotten them in more massive quantities because we allowed ourselves to be silenced. Because if the voice of the public interest is not in this, what do you have left? It's just the corporate spin campaigns that are out competing each other for their corporate campaign dollars. So you get this accelerating slide to the right on education, on health care, you name it. And that health care, you know, the Affordable Care Act. I live in the state that already has it. And in fact, medical bankruptcies have not been impacted at all. Health care is every bit as much unaffordable and unavailable and out of reach as it ever has been. The Affordable Care Act, unfortunately, is more cover for more Wall Street health insurance and pharmaceutical boondoggles. We need Medicare for all. So again, you know, we've hit that breaking point. Time to turn it into the tipping point. Rejecting that politics of fear and replacing it with the politics of courage. Like what the Chicago Teachers Union is demonstrating. Because at the end of the day, it's always been the politics of courage that has led us forward. It's that social movement out in the street that abolished slavery, that got the women, right, women's right to vote, that established the right of unions to organize, to have a 40-hour work week and safe workplaces. But in addition to a movement on the ground, it takes an independent political party to really drive home the solutions. That's why FDR actually, you know, implemented the New Deal and Social Security and all the rest, and we got the Labor Relations Act passed because there was a third-party threat. And they knew that if they didn't act, they were going to have big trouble on their hands. So it really takes the independent third party. They want you to think that third parties are ineffective because they're very afraid of our power. But in fact, that's where we really leverage the power of the social movements. And in fact, it's that alliance of a social movement and an independent political party that makes us unstoppable. So that's what we need to do in November, as we're doing right now. We have the politics of courage out in the street. We need to bring that politics of courage into the voting booth as well, because that's where we really lock in on our demands and drive them forward. If we only vote with our feet and we don't vote with our votes, everything we do out there with our feet is basically going to be crushed by the continuing repression in the voting booth. But by our standing up, we can begin to turn this breaking point into a tipping point and start to take back our democracy and the future we deserve. So I'll just end by thanking you for leading the charge here and encourage you as part of your work in building this transformation, which really is happening, and where the Chicago Teachers Union is playing a critical role in upping the ante in that transformation. You really are. I tell people my role in this campaign is that of being a political therapist by way of helping people to get out from under an abusive political relationship. To break up with your abuser and stop making their apologies your own words. Become a part of the network, because our model here is Tahrir Square and Tunisia, and that's what they have. They have the power of their vision, the power of their ideals, and especially the power of a generation that has nowhere else to go, and we very much have that in our country. Not only a generation of young students who've been abandoned and who are being abandoned by our education system, but also the generation in college and who are graduating, who are indentured servants and who have no jobs with which to pay back their very onerous and unforgiving student loans. So this is really an incredible, unstoppable motor for social change. There's no way it's going to be stopped. And the question is whether we will have peaceful change or whether it will degenerate into something terrible. So what we're doing, what the Chicago teachers are doing, is paving the way for us to have a peaceful social and political transformation. So in my role as political therapist, I want to just underscore how absolutely transformative and empowering and liberating your work is right now. So from the bottom of my heart, I want to thank you from all across the nation for the incredible work that you are doing to take back our democracy and the peaceful, just, green future that we deserve. It's in your hands. You are making it happen.
That was Dr. Jill Stein, who was born and raised in Illinois and who was named the 2012 presidential candidate for the Green Party of the United States. Jill Stein's campaign website is www.jillstein.org, and Jill Stein is spelled J-I-L-L-S-T-E-I-N. We're coming to you from the trenches.
When I was just 9 or 10, I ran for the school president to fix some things when troubles all were mounting. I was running on a strong platform of soggy tater tot reform and putting Sprite in all the water fountains. But then I saw just down the way my opponent Bobby Joe McKay was putting up some campaign signs himself. And when I looked up at that wall and patiently just read them all, asked what do you have to say for yourself? Well, it's called free speech. It's called free speech. Something the Constitution guarantees. Some folks might be offended, but we all have to defend it if we truly want this country to be free.
Imagine that you're an Illinois resident and an Illinois public employee, and that you're suing your employer in court on grounds saying that your employer defamed you. State law in Illinois grants you protection in theory, but a recent chilling development could change things dramatically and grant protection to the government employer instead of the employee, even putting the legal costs on the employee. In brief, that describes the situation of Loretta Capehart, a professor at Northeastern Illinois University in Chicago, who has found herself struggling against her own university over her rights of free speech, and whose case could prove devastating for political activists in Illinois and nationally. We'll learn more about Loretta Capehart and the chilling implications of her case in this interview with Mitchell Stepinchuk, recorded on Sunday, September 2nd, 2012.
You've been involved with a bit of a struggle with your employer, Northeastern Illinois University, NEIU. Before we get into that, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your own personal background and your academic focus. What do you study and what do you teach?
I did my doctorate in sociology with a special attention on crime and criminology. And I teach justice studies, which is a fairly broad liberal arts degree dealing with all kinds of social justice issues, not just crime and criminality, but also like one of the things I teach is a white collar crime and elite deviance course, courses on theories of social change and how that comes through social activism, social movements. So that's sort of my focus in my academic career.
How long have you been on the faculty at Northeastern?
This is starting my 11th year. I've been there 10 years.
You also had been elected chair of the Justice Studies Department where you teach, but the department, while your colleagues at school had voted you with this honor, the administration apparently took issue with this. Can you talk a little bit about what happened?
Sure. Like I said, I'd been on the campus at that point about 6-7 years. I'd already earned tenure, been there a long time, established myself as, an academic, a teacher, and excellence and so forth in order to be granted tenure. And I was elected to chair the department. But the administration had taken a very dim view of me, particularly the current president, Sharon Haas, and her provost, who has now left the university, Provost Frank, as well as another vice president who has also now left the university, mainly regarding my activism on campus. I'm a longtime activist against the war. I lost a nephew in the war in 2005 and had actually been active against the war from the day it started, knowing that, I was not the only person with loved ones at risk because of the war. But certainly had been especially active since my own personal loss. And the administration was very non-welcoming of activism against the war on campus, had threatened to arrest me at one point, threatened to take administrative action against me, all sorts of things for just, basically doing what people do about flyers. That's as egregious as my activism got, was handing out flyers, and they did not take kindly to that. And so they didn't see me as someone they wanted in that position. And this was one of the retaliatory acts they took against me because of my speech, was to refuse to appoint me as chair of the department. That hadn't happened on our campus in like 25 years. It's very normal that once you're elected by your peers, that you will then be appointed.
To be frank here, you teach and have taught about and have studied political activism, and yet, it seems like if you're allowed to do that and they pay you for doing that, even granting you tenure, and yet engaging in something is what probably has maybe not as much reach as handing out flyers to probably random passersby or at a rally or something. Why did the, I don't know if you can read into their minds or maybe they said so, why has the administration taken an approach that seems like would be more dovetailing with what you have done and taught rather than reacting irrationally here?
Yeah, I certainly have my views about that, and I think it's because of the corporate agenda that's taken hold in academia has become so intense of late. Our prior president, Salome Steinberg, probably wasn't my greatest fan, but she certainly didn't take this sort of punitive attitude toward me. But when the new administration came in, when Sharon Haas took the leadership role as the president, things on campus changed quite radically. Not just her retaliations against me, she actually tried to put in what she called a free speech code, which was so draconian that it was immediately rejected by the faculty senate. Now, of course, she made it clear to the senate that she could impose it without their approval, that she was just sending it by them for feedback. She ended up not imposing it, interestingly enough, because the outcry was so strong. The policy was actually quite similar to what Rahm Emanuel put in place just before the NATO conference, which was that there could be no rallies without prior approval. If you were going to hand out flyers, they had to be approved by the administration in advance. If you were going to carry signs, picket signs on the campus, they had to be approved by the administration in advance. And she tried to put this through during a time when our union was attempting to negotiate a contract. So it was clearly not just against, the kinds of political activism like anti-war and pro-immigrant activism that we have on campus quite regularly, but also clearly aimed against the union rallies that we were organizing and holding at the time.
This again kind of smacks of Orwell, I suppose, where, in fact, I remember hearing that there's a saying I remember hearing that the entirety of the United States is a free speech zone, or should be. I've been involved myself in political efforts where I and others have been corralled into what have been euphemistically referred to as free speech zones, and which mm-hmm. would basically amount to places where basically to try to cover people who are willing to stand up to say what they believe and to stand up against repressive forces and try to sweep them under the rugs in one or another way. Go ahead.
I was going to say, we've had a free speech zone at Northeastern since I've been there. Now, there have been many people who've sort of resisted it and presented their speech in other areas, but the particular policy I was talking about earlier certainly was very clear in its limitations of when it, not just where we could speak, but when we could speak. And on a campus that runs almost 24/7, because they're quite, anxious to get as many student dollars as they possibly can, they're not as anxious to allow voices that broadly, and so they had limited the times and the place that people could speak freely, which, again, as you say, is completely counter to what we expect in a so-called free country, where we should be able to speak freely anywhere we please without fear of retaliation or arrest.
And this kind of also connects into the issue with regards to freedom of speech on in education generally. You would figure that colleges and universities in the United States, in fact anywhere, should be hubs of informed debate and where free exchanges of opinion can and should be encouraged to take place, and especially and including those opinions that for whatever reason might be deemed unpopular, whether or not people might find them abhorrent on... I hate to use the example, but I'll do it anyway. Those that basically align themselves with Nazi opinion, whereas those mm-hmm. that also might be aligned with perhaps those that you and I might more align with as far as those mm-hmm. that might be traditionally espoused with those in the political left, for example. Go ahead.
Exactly. And, the AUP has a very strong and clear statement on academic freedom and academic speech.
You're referring to the Association of American University Professors, AAUP.
Right, I'm sorry, the American Association of University Professors. And that's sort of the tradition within academia, that yes, this is where we discuss, this is where we debate, where we have these kinds of discussions and should be allowed these kinds of discussions. And while our current president, Sharon Haas, will say publicly that the AUP is the gold standard, she then will turn around and impose something that's totally contrary to the AUP's norms and expectations, which is why the AUP has been very supportive of me in my case, because they recognize that the stakes here are very much at the heart of academic freedom, which is at the heart of free speech and freedom, which is at the heart of democracy. And so these things are very clearly connected, and that a university president would stand against these things is absolutely despicable, and that she would do so at a campus like mine is truly outrageous, because Northeastern Illinois University, for people who may not know, is one of the most diverse campuses in the Midwest and the country, actually. Many of our students, I would guess the majority still at this point, even though things have changed recently, are first-generation college students, as was I, are working-class students, as was I, are minority students, as am I, speak something other than English at home, as do I, right? And so these are the kinds of students who are most in need of recognizing their potential, of recognizing their voice, and seeing a lead of that from the faculty, that, yes, what you say matters, you have a space to say it, and we should be very clear about it, right? 10% of our students are veterans, and that we can't feel comfortable to discuss the war on our campus is criminal, right? That we can't feel comfortable trying to protect our students from, very active and aggressive recruiting on our campus is despicable. That I don't have the right as a faculty member to say, hey, you should really consider these things before you sign up for the military. And then, of course, personally, this isn't just about what I feel is my obligation as a faculty member, but it feels my obligation as a Gold Star aunt that I need to say, you need to think very clearly about what you're committing to if you're thinking about going into the military. And so there's, that this is going on my campus, I find particularly offensive, because I chose to come to this campus because of the student body there, because I felt this is a place where my teaching and scholarship could really make a difference. And then to have that shut down by someone who really doesn't understand our student body is particularly heartbreaking.
On the issue of the administration and this kind of, I'll use another term for Orwell again, doublespeak, where they will say one thing but do something dramatically different, sometimes the complete inverse of the opposite. Have the university administration, that of Sharon Haas and her staff, been held to account with regards to, you know, espousing the AAUP standard regarding freedom of speech on campus and yet enacting in these crackdowns?
Not directly. They have received some letters. They've also very recently refused to tenure one of my colleagues, an outstanding scholar, an outstanding teacher in our linguistics department, refused to grant him tenure because everyone else in his department voted no confidence in the president last year in the Faculty Senate. It's a clear retaliation. They've clearly used standards for review that are not included in the actual process that's very carefully constructed. This gentleman was passed through every level, from his department to the dean to the university personnel committee, and then in an absolute yes, you know, tenure and promote. This is an outstanding scholar, outstanding teacher, outstanding service to the university. And when it gets to the president's desk, she decides that she is not going to tenure this faculty member and gives him a year until he needs to vacate the university, which, again, it's just, it's despicable. And the AUP has reviewed that. I'm on the Committee A of the AUP in Illinois, which is the Committee for Academic Freedom and Tenure. And we were horrified by what is going on in that case as well, that here's someone who's done an outstanding job, is loved by his colleagues and his students, and yet the president, that high up, has decided not to tenure him for some reasons that are clearly not related to his work, not related to his review, and in the opinion of many, is because his colleagues openly voted no confidence in the president in our Senate meeting last year. So, yeah, there's been attention to the campus. I'm hoping there will be more because things are not getting better. And, of course, we fear that they'll get worse given the current political climate. And I don't know if you've heard about our campus radio station. The student campus radio station was also shut down without any due process. They call it the Wizards, WZRD.
WZRD, yes, I'm very familiar with it. I've actually been on the station myself a number of times.
Super. And those students were just basically shut down without due process, without any sort of understanding of what was going on, and they are also attempting to fight that, again, what they see as a violation of their rights as students on the campus. And given what I've seen of it, I have to agree with them that they have been, that their academic freedom has been violated, their rights as students have been violated, the whole process that's supposed to take place. If students actually do, of course, every now and then the student group will do something where there needs to be a response to it, but this is not what's happened here, and it's really despicable that because the campus seems to have decided that they want to corporatize that radio station, put in a bunch of podcasts, and run it from the top down, they first decide they've got to get rid of the student club in the current format, you know, again, without any real reasons or process. And that's totally, again, contrary to what the student radio station is supposed to be, is a student-run station run by the students. They decide if they want to go to a podcast format or if they want to keep what they've got, and it shouldn't be decided, you know, in some student affairs office and then imposed on the students. That's completely wrong, in my view.
And there's more to it than just that. It's not just students. WZRD has, as far as I've known the station now almost 9 years, has had a very strong component of non-student participation and involvement to which the station should be credited, and which I fear might be lost if this crackdown might continue.
I think you're right.
The speaking of student clubs, you yourself have also received some heat with regards to your advising of a student club on Northeastern Illinois University campus. Tell us a little bit more about that and what's been happening with that.
Well, the Socialist Club I had been the sponsor of since I came to campus almost back in 2002, fall of 2002. And It was a very active club, again, with anti-war stuff. They were very active. When we used to have this really nasty homophobic group that would come to campus and hand out hate literature, and they were very active in putting up a response to that, along with the GLBTA group and the feminist majority and other groups on campus that were progressive. In 2007, there was an action by the anti-war club, which I don't sponsor or you know, or have, I don't, I have any direct connection with them. Of course, I support their work. Had a very small demonstration against the CIA who'd come to campus to do some recruiting. And out of that peaceful demonstration, two students were arrested. And it just so happened that the two that were arrested were also members of the Socialist Club, which the university had long had a nasty attitude toward, to such an extent that the dean of students once had to have one of his staff apologize because she was so nasty towards the students. It was a purely political issue. The students had never done anything wrong. But these two students who were arrested, I was very concerned and tried to get them released while they were on campus. They refused. They sent them over to the Chicago police, which I found horrifying. And they would not drop the charges, even though they were clearly unsubstantiated and outrageous. And because of that, attempts to support those students, the vice president of student affairs, in a meeting of faculty and other people, said that I should be careful what I say. What I was saying was, let's see if we can find a better way to deal with students than arresting them. And he said, I should be careful what I say because a student had filed stalking charges against me. Of course, I was horrified by that. I can't imagine how that could be. I'd never stalked anyone in my life, let alone a student. But he persisted in claiming that that was the case. About a year later, I was finally able to get access to what the heck he could possibly be talking about. I found that there were absolutely never any stalking charges against me. And he still refused to retract and apologize. And this is where things started getting really ugly, because clearly, had I been actually charged with stalking a student, that would be the end of my career, as it should be. You know, that sort of behavior shouldn't be tolerated on a college campus. I'd be the first to say that. But that wasn't the case. And yet the administration just kept clinging to that story and wouldn't apologize, wouldn't retract. I went through a whole grievance process on the campus and the works, and they just refused to back off that. And out of that grew this nasty characterization of myself and the Socialist Club as somehow creating problems and chaos on the campus. And there was an attempt even by the student government to have the Socialist Club thrown off the campus. Now, at the time, we had a really outstanding president of the club, and she defended them very well and got them to back off because, as she, you know, she clearly pointed out, this wasn't an action of the Socialist Club. Had it been, she would be just as vocal in defending, and she would defend the anti-war club, but that there was absolutely no reason to come after that club. But again, instigated from the top that, you know, somehow I and this club need to be dealt with, when in fact what happened was there was a wrongful arrest, in my opinion, a wrongful arrest of students for engaging in peaceful protest on the campus. And so there's this creation of these crises that didn't have to be met with this top-down, you know, shut them down, shut them up, very similar to what's happening to WZRD now. The club has not remained active in recent years because the pressures and the retaliation had become so severe that I think many students didn't feel safe functioning on the campus.
There's another incident that I'd like to also discuss with you. I'm reading an excerpt from a website that's been organized to rally on your behalf, justiceforloretta.com, with the word for replaced with the numeral four, justiceforloretta.com. On the On that website, there's a portion of text that reads, on June 19, 2012, Cook County Judge Randy Kogan granted NEIU and Vice President Melvin Terrell immunity under the Illinois Citizens Participation Act, the CPA as it's called. Unless overturned on appeal, this ruling will make Professor Capehart liable for the university's legal tab in addition to her own legal expenses. Ironically, the CPA was a piece of legislation fought for and won by consumer advocates in order to protect citizens who speak out publicly against powerful corporate and government interests. Now this ruling in Roloretta's case turns the original intention of the CPA on its head by granting immunity to a powerful interest and leveling a terrible penalty on a citizen for speaking out. The precedent set for other citizen activists in Illinois is chilling. Any individual who speaks out against a corporate or government entity in Illinois could potentially be sued for slander and held liable for the corporation or government's legal tab. The decision could have a legal impact in other states that have passed or are considering consumer protection legislation like the CPA in Illinois. Hearing this and reading this, it sounds to me and echoes the rather draconian libel laws that they have in Britain, where the burden is on the person who actually gives the speech, even though it's not a freedom of speech issue. It actually, rather than a kind of innocent until proven guilty, you're guilty by default, and the situation is that you have to try to exonerate yourself somehow. Sometimes that may not even be possible. What are your thoughts in the case of all of this situation as you try to fight what's been going on with the CPA?
You know, it is really, you know, you used the word Orwellian earlier, and that is exactly what it is. It is so outrageous that I have a hard time. It's taken me months to really wrap my head around this and get a real, it's like, is that what happened? Because it's so outlandish. So again, the law was put into place to protect people exactly like me. So that if I were to say, hey, you know, I don't like the way this university is doing X, they couldn't sue me for saying that, as they shouldn't, right? I'm a citizen. I should have the right to, you know, be critical of my government or any of its entities and be safe in that. Now, what they've done is just completely turn that upside down. And because Melvin Terrell did slander me, it's slander per se in the law, meaning that he said something about me as if it were a fact, and if it actually were true, is very damaging to me, right? Just the fact of saying, you know, you are a sex felon. That's what stalking is. It's a felony sex crime. So he basically said that about me, a professor, that I had done that to a student. I can't imagine anything more damaging. And so he did slander me. And this is what the one of the points of the case is that that slander has to be taken back. It has to be dealt with. This thing has to be, I have to be made whole here. I can't go through the rest of my career with this statement standing in the minutes of a meeting. And yet it still is standing in the minutes of a meeting. And because I tried to get them to redress that, they are now countersuing me, saying that, you know, that I don't have the right to do that, that they are the citizen, and that not only are they protected from criticizing me, they could criticize me all they want, say, well, we don't agree with you, we don't like you, whatever, your hair is ugly, that's fine, right? But when you slander me, that's a different thing. And they're saying that because they did slander me, and because they have the right to engage in government, and because I've now brought this claim against them for slander, I'm responsible for their legal bills. It's absolutely, it turns the whole law upside down and puts all of us in a very scary position, because now, I mean, I'm thinking about the CTU a lot lately, the Chicago Teachers Union, because they're putting up a hell of a fight, and I'm so proud and I'm so hopeful that they're going to win something good for all of us. And imagine a teacher going before, you know, the school board and saying, you know, we really hope that the school will do a better job next year in, you know, supporting X program. And the board comes back and says, well, you better watch yourself because you're a child rapist, and so you better watch what you say. And then she has to sit there and take that, because if she defends herself, she'll have to pay their legal tab, which they will inflate greatly, as the Northeastern has done. They're saying they've spent $80,000 on that one claim. That's what the judge, you know, has the right to say, I have to write a check for. Now, that will silence all criticism of the government, all criticism, because what citizen is going to put themselves forward to be called a felony sex criminal if they question what's going on, and then they can't get that redress. They can't say, no, I'm not, and you can't say that about me because it's not true. Because if they make that claim, you can't say that about me because it's not true, then you violated the Citizens Protection Act, because now the government is a citizen, just like a corporation is a person. Therefore, you're liable. It is a very scary precedent. I cannot believe that this judge has made this decision, but she did. And we are going to do our best to appeal it and get it overturned, because to leave that standing as precedent is just unacceptable. It's unacceptable.
I'd like to talk a little bit about the support network that you've had and the network of people who have been rallying to this entire array of struggles with regards to Northeastern that you've wound yourself facing. Tell us a little bit about how big it is, what the support has been like, and how this has helped you to fight back.
Well, it's been humbling. It's been amazing. I've been struggling with this so long that it's just unfortunately become a part of my life. And to see this group develop and pull together people who are serious about protecting free speech and academic freedom has just been amazing and remarkable. And I'm incredibly grateful. As I said before, the AAUP is supporting my case with the National AAUP. One of the people who's been organizing this Justice for Loretta campaign is a professor at the University of Vermont, and her AAUP chapter is supporting now. They sent a substantial contribution, which has been very helpful in trying to fight back on some of this stuff. And then we've had, a $5 contribution to a $5,000 contribution, it hasn't mattered. Just that people care, that people are willing to say, hey, you know what, this matters, and you shouldn't have to fight this alone. This is about all of us. And they send in whatever. I just tear up every time we get any size contribution, because I recognize that this isn't about me. This isn't about one person. This is about our rights as people on this planet, that we should be able to criticize our government, that we should be able to speak, that we should be able to protect our students. We should be able to have a voice and not fear that voice is going to land us in all kinds of trouble when we're trying to have a positive impact on how things are going. And things are going so badly right now. I think we need every voice out there. And I think others agree, and that's why they've been so supportive. That the network is, several people here in Chicago who meet regularly, to all the way out to, in Vermont, California. We had a nice note and donation this morning from somebody up in Canada, in Ottawa. So it's quite broad, and I'm very grateful, very grateful.
That was Loretta Capehart in an interview recorded on September 2nd, 2012. Again, the website mentioned in the interview is justiceforloretta.com. That is the word justice, the number for Loretta, Loretta.com. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. To learn more and get involved in making media, including helping to make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Rita Sand. Thank you for listening, and be sure to join us again for another episode From the Trenches.